Thanks for tuning in to the Next Level Church podcast. If you've never attended in person, we'd love to have you join us on Sunday mornings at 9:30 or 11:05 at 3105 Hampton Highway in Yorktown, Virginia. For more information, check out our website at nextlevelchurch.net.
Hey, good morning to you. Happy Thanksgiving weekend. Hopefully everyone has already worked off all the sleepiness from all that turkey over the weekend, over the week. Very excited for you guys to be here today. My name is Rob. I'm one of the pastors at Next Level Church. And today we're doing something a little bit different. We're doing a live Q&A. And here's how this works. We've done this about five times before over the 2.5 years of our existence. But here's how this works. The sermon or the talk is really going to be driven by you. And so you can ask any question that has anything to do with God or the Bible or church, anything that is on your mind, anything you've been dying to know or you want a different take on it, you get to drive where the talk goes. And so there's a number up on the screen, and you can anonymously text it in, and then they will post the questions as they get them. So as you think of a question, just send it to them. If you think of more questions based off answers that I've given, you can submit more than one question. This is totally, completely done by you. And I do want to give a disclaimer that this is not something that we have rehearsed. Every time we do this, someone comes up to me afterwards and says, you had plants in the service, didn't you, that were asking questions so you could prepare in advance. I don't have a fat clue what you guys are going to ask. We have no pre-prep questions. We have no one that is out there sitting there saying, let me ask this question. If you guys don't ask questions, this is going to be a long 35 minutes because I have nothing to say. I haven't prepped the talk. Like, I don't know what I will do. I will try to sing and dance, and we'll all be in trouble. So this is really driven by you. So as you have questions, go ahead and text them. There is no question that is too off the wall, too random. I want you to be authentic. I want you to say what is really on your heart, really what you're struggling with, what's on your mind, what you've wondered about. You can send in those questions. Now, if you're a first-time guest with us, something that we do each and every week is we partnered with a free app called YouVersion. And YouVersion is a chance for you to engage with the Bible, and you can actually do this weekly, daily if you want to. I participate in YouVersion daily, but every week on every Sunday, we have a live section of YouVersion, and instructions should be coming up on the screen at any second for you, maybe. There they are. If the instructions on how to get to the live page are up there on the screen. And today is a little bit different in YouVersion. There's a question of the week for you to answer. But the thing that I really would like for you to focus on is even though there's not a set talk, there is still a chance for you to take some notes. So if you hear something and want to take notes, you can do that through YouVersion. You can even email the notes to yourself. Also, if you have a prayer request, you can send those prayer requests to us, and our prayer team will cover of those. You can do all that through YouVersion. And so let's put the number back up there so people can get their questions back in. Text your questions to 757-912-0046. And I think we have our first question up. Maybe. No. Okay, so we'll keep stalling. Yeah, we will stall, and I'll find something to talk about as you guys text your questions in. It says, I know, but I guess that's not. Oh, there it is. I think, is that first question ready? By the way, another disclaimer with this is because this is unrehearsed, unpracticed, there's a great chance that I won't know the answer to all of your questions. And so you'll hear some ums, you'll hear some stalling, you'll hear, I even brought my Bible. This is my Bible that I've had since I was a junior in high school, that I might flip through this and say, I think there's a verse in there somewhere. I may even throw it back on you and say, hey, I've heard this, but you need to do some research and find this out. This is completely unrehearsed and unpracticed. I have no idea what's going on, and I think we have a question now. Do we have a question now? There it is. I know saving ourselves from marriage. Why is this important? I know. Okay. I'm going to decipher what that question is asking. I think it's saying, I know saving ourselves as far as sexual purity for marriage, but why is this important? I think that's a great question that our culture is not asking. And I think it is a great question because I think it's ultimately how God has designed intimacy and marriage. That in our culture, sex is something that happens pretty much immediately. It's something that happens pretty quickly. It is, if we have some chemistry, we need to test this out to make sure we're a good match. And we'll experiment, we'll live together, we'll have sex before marriage. And that's worked out I guess, for some people. But I think a better system and a way better plan is God's intended purpose for intimacy. And intimacy is supposed to be a result of commitment. Intimacy is not the start of a relationship, it is the end. When you realize and know that you have someone that you're committed to for the rest of your life, intimacy is the result. And so, for my understanding, God's ultimate plan is that not that you would have intimacy with a bunch of different people, but that you would find one person and you would say, I'm committed to them, and the end result of our relationship together equals intimacy. At the end of the day, if you are single, and especially if you're a teenager, you're asking these questions. If you're an older single, and I don't mean old, but I'm about to give a number, and I know some of us are insecure about our age. But if you're an older single, like in your 30s, that doesn't mean you're old, but you're really asking this question, saying, are you serious? Are you saying that God's plan is for me to wait? And I would say yes, that ultimately it is best to wait. Why? Because intimacy is a result of commitment. Intimacy should never end in, sex should never end in guilt. It should never end in saying, man, I wish I wouldn't have gone there. I wish I wouldn't have done that. Intimacy should end with saying, yeah, I've committed to this person for the rest of my life, and so the end result is us bonding together in intimacy. And I believe that intimacy, that sex, is the glue of a marriage relationship. I've never, ever met a married couple that had a great marriage and an awful sex life. And I've never, ever met a married couple that had a great sex life and an awful marriage. Like, the two go together. Why? Because intimacy is a result of commitment. And if, for all you that are married out there, you know that if intimacy is going well in your marriage, everything else is lined up. If there's something else that is off, if the finances are off and it's causing your wife a lot of stress, intimacy is going to suffer. If there is stress, if the man's not helping around the house, if they're not feeling supported, if the guy is not feeling connected to his wife, like, intimacy is the end result. And so ultimately in a marriage relationship, it is incredibly important because intimacy is a result of commitment. And it is the glue of your relationship to say, hey, we are good. We are bonding together in this amazing gift that God gave us called intimacy. And that is why it's ultimately the end result for married couples. So hopefully I didn't butcher that one too bad. How should we, I think we got another question up there. How should we digest the book? Oh, good golly. How should we digest the book of Leviticus? Verses we don't follow at all, but others we do. Why? Okay. I think whoever asked this question, maybe you can follow up if I'm not interpreting your question exactly. The Old Testament, and especially in the early books of the Old Testament, like Leviticus, they give us some rules and some laws that God gave to his children, to the children of Israel, some things that he said, don't do this, and he was very adamant about it. It is where you'll get, if you ever post anything on social media about God is against homosexuality, someone will apply, they'll reply by also saying, well, God is against shellfish, because God said that eating shellfish is an abomination as well. And so they'll hold to that verse, and a lot of verses like that come from Leviticus. And most Christians dismiss a lot of Leviticus, but then we hold on to certain parts that we like in Leviticus. So if I understand the question, is how should we digest it in the sense that there are some things that we say, I don't apply that, I don't live by that, but there are other things that we do. It is my understanding, and I'm going to totally butcher the terms of this, but there are some cultural laws that God established to the children of Israel, to his people, that those cultural laws no longer apply to us. Because especially us, we would be what they would call Gentiles. We are not the Israelites. And so there are certain things that God said, this is for those people in those times, and those verses do not apply to us. The verses that do apply to us are the moral laws. And a moral law is something like the Ten Commandments, when it says, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt honor your father and your mother. Those are moral laws, and the moral laws are good for all people in all places in all times. So if it is a moral law, then we can say, yeah, we're going to still hold to that. If it is a cultural law, and it was something that was specifically for the children of Israel, we can say God gave that to them for a specific reason, a specific time, but that doesn't apply to us anymore. Now, why would God do that? Well, you got to put yourself in his shoes. He has a people that he has just rescued. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of people who have come out of slavery from Egypt. They have no government. They have no laws. They have no authority. There's no president. There's no king. There is nothing. It is a hundreds of people out in the wilderness with no standards, and they're coming from a more pagan nation that believed a lot of things that were very contrary to what God was teaching them. And so God's commands to them was trying to set up a way for them to survive. And so if you read Leviticus, there are some things in there that talk about, like, don't mix mother's milk with something. It's a weird verse about milk. I don't even understand it. And don't mix, like, certain fabrics, and stay away from these foods, especially foods with, like, a split hoof. And it's giving you all these rules. Well, they applied to them because you got to think, they are plopped out in the wilderness. They don't have cleaning utensils. They don't have hospitals. They don't have science to help them know, you know, what is clean and not. And so God is establishing a whole rule of order for people to live in order to survive. And so there's lots of things that he threw at them that for us now, we can say, I can see why God did that. I can see why God said that. I can see why God said stay away from, you know, pigs, because pigs were pretty dirty. But now today, thanks be to God, we can eat bacon. And so that doesn't apply to us. That doesn't apply to us anymore. And so that was good for them, because it's a cultural law that was just for the children of Israel. It is very different than a moral law. And so when I read the book of Leviticus, I'm asking this question. Is this a cultural law that God was trying to help establish Israel and trying to help them survive and help them stand out from the rest of the world? Or is this a moral law? Is this a law that God has given that it applies to all people and all times and all circumstances? If that did not answer your question, whoever is reading Leviticus out there, text again. Good question. All right, I think we have another question. The reaction to Ferguson has seemed to vary sharply between the white and black community. How are we as Christians called to respond? Man, that's an incredible question. Thank you, whoever asked that question. I think that the way that we should respond comes from a place of having some humility, to understand that, especially if you're a white American, your circumstances are very different than a minority in America. And so when you see a post or a reaction out there and you can't respond to it or you can't relate to it, it doesn't mean that it's wrong. And I think that we are called to mourn with those who mourn, especially in the Christian community. And it's very easy as Christians to say, okay, because I disagree with why they're mourning, I'm just going to throw everything out and not agree with them. And it's very easy to post these snarky posts on Facebook that kind of say, how silly are you to be rioting about this, and how silly are you to be causing this is a big deal, and let's make a villain out of this. And I think that our response as Christians is to say, even if I disagree, there's a huge population in America that is mourning and is struggling. And I don't have a perfect answer for this, but I read an article that was very interesting on this, about the differences of raising a white son in America and a black son in America. And they interviewed this guy and just asked him, what are some of the things that you have to teach your son? And it's very different than anything my dad had to teach me. And it just went down this list of things. It went through a list of things, like, if you were ever leaving a store, never have a closed fist, because someone might think that you're stealing something. So walk out of a store with an open hand. My dad's never had to say that to me. It was things like, if you are running and you see cops anywhere, stop running, because they're going to think that maybe you've done something. And so just stop running. It said things like, if you're carrying, if you're playing with a play gun, like, be very careful with what you do. It could get mistaken. I mean, there were all these rules and lists. That's something my dad never had to talk to me about, because I'm a white kid in America. And so I think that even if I disagree with the reaction to what's happened in Ferguson, and even if I disagree with some people's opinions, I think I'm called to mourn with those who are mourning, and say, I don't completely agree, but I understand that you're hurting, and you're hurting because you are in a totally different circumstance than I am. You were raised in a different environment, and you have to go through things that I can't even fathom. And so I'm gonna try my best to mourn with you, and try my best to, and I'll just tell you this. I think ultimately our reaction, if you are a white American in here today, your reaction should be to go befriend some minorities. And I think that it totally changes your situation when you take someone off of the news and off of Facebook, and you actually interact with them over a meal, and you hang out with them. And if you don't have minorities that are friends, I think it'll help change your perspective. It can help even ask you. So you can ask them this question. Sit across from coffee with them and say, hey, I don't understand. Can you help me understand why this is going on, or this take? And I think it'll completely transform your response to this. But ultimately, the question was, how are we called to respond? I think we're called to respond by mourning with those who are mourning, even if we don't agree with everything that's going on. Hopefully that answered that question. Let's keep going. We got another question. These are good. What do you think heaven actually is? Do you think we can experience it here on earth, since we're working to bring heaven to earth as Jesus taught us to pray? Great question. I think that heaven, we're going to do a series on heaven in 2015. I've been thinking a lot about heaven, and I'm very excited to talk about heaven because I think that heaven, our view of heaven is completely jacked up. We always picture heaven as being this white place with some angels and some harp music, and it is the most boring place on earth. It looks a lot like what I picture hell to be. I mean, it is not exciting. like when I see a picture of like heaven in the media, I'm not like, I can't wait to get there. No, it looks so boring. And I just want to throw this out there that like the God who invented colors, why is he going to make heaven all white? Like, I mean, think about this. Like, the God that invented rainbows. Like, I think we're going to see colors that we've never experienced before. I think it's going to blow our mind. But ultimately, I do think there are going to, and this is just an opinion, okay? I've never been to heaven, so I can't speak on what it looks like. But I think ultimately there are going to be pieces of heaven that we can relate to here on earth. I think there's going to be things that we're going to say, oh, that made sense to me. I prepped. I think this world and the way you live your life is prepping for the afterlife, for how you're going to live throughout eternity. Now, the real spin on this, the real kind of twist, is in the book of Revelation, the last book of our New Testament, Jesus says that he is going to bring a new heaven and a new earth. And that is a part that then really just blows my mind, because a lot of Christians say that our final resting place is in heaven one day, but I think there's a lot of proof that says, no, one day, after all is said and done, and God is done with everything and has wiped away all the tears and all the pain and suffering, he's going to create a new earth, and we get to actually experience earth the way it was originally intended to experience it, without tornadoes, without disasters, without anger, without suffering, without pain, without calories, without gaining weight. We're going to be able to experience earth the way that God originally intended it. And so it's just my understanding. I think ultimately we're going to end up back here in a perfect place. Did I answer the question? I don't even know. What did you think heaven actually is? Yeah, I think it's going to be amazing and blow our mind. That's what I think it is. So let's go to another question. If you are thinking about a sinful act, have you committed a sin? Is it the thought or the act or both? Wow. Props to whoever asked that question. You got a bigger response than any talk I've ever given at Next Level Church. That's good. If you're thinking about a sinful act, have you committed a sin? Is it the thought or the act or both? Just off the cuff, I think the answer is yes. let me explain. Jesus did talk about, he talked about that there was this idea that the people that he was around was so strict on the letter of the law that they constantly were missing the heart behind the law. And so Jesus comes and they ask him about divorce, and he says, listen, the only reason that Moses and the law permitted divorce is because your hearts were hard, but I'm telling you, unless you commit adultery, you can't get a divorce. And what was Jesus saying? Was he saying another like if, ands, or buts, like you have to follow us to the T? No, he was trying to get back to the heart of why God gave us any standards or commands. And along those lines, Jesus did say, if you look at a woman lustfully, it's the same thing as actually sinning with her. And if you are angry in your heart at another person, it is the exact same thing as murder. So I do think that there are some instances where just the thought alone is the exact same thing as actually doing it. I think lust, a good rule of thumb for lust is if you wouldn't do it in person, you shouldn't do it in your mind, okay? If you wouldn't ask a woman to take off her clothes, you should not picture her with her clothes off. If you wouldn't touch a woman in a certain place because you're not with her, then you shouldn't touch her in your mind. You should just set that barrier up in your mind. And I think anger is another big one, that if anger is ultimately a result of what's going on in your heart. So if you're thinking, I can't stand this person, even though you've never lashed out at them, there needs to be some heart dealing and some kind of wrestling in your heart. You need to ask God to work on your heart. But there are other things that are simply temptations. And so, if I think about going and eating more dessert, but I don't actually do it, then that's not sin. And so that's why I think the answer is like, yes, there are certain things that it's like, you know, I thought about it. I thought about punching them out, but I'm not going to punch them out. Like that is very different. But there are certain things. I think lust is a big one. Anger is a big one. Selfishness, if there are things that are just kind of going through your mind, thinking about it, can be the same thing as sin, but I don't know if it's a black or white. because there are definitely some temptation. Being tempted is not a sin. Being tempted to, steal something or to lie, that you haven't committed a sin then. But I think some emotions, though, are more than just a temptation. I think those are some things that Jesus was talking about. So well played, whoever asked that question. Let's keep going. How do you reconcile the extremely violent God of the Old Testament with the radically non-violent Jesus? Next question. No, I'm just joking. There's a book that I'm actually reading right now that is addressing this this very topic. It's called The Skeletons in God's Closet. And I'm not that far into it to know if it's a great book or not, but I bought the book with the intention of trying to answer and wrestle with this question. Because if you dive into the Old Testament and you don't get very far into it where you're like, we start reading where God's saying, I want you to go in and wipe out every man, woman, and child and just destroy them all. And then you're like, that's not very nice. And then you read about Jesus and this radical love where he said, turn the other cheek if someone strikes you. And so how do the two things go together? I don't think that there is a black or white answer for this. In fact, this is something that people have been wrestling with for hundreds of years. And if you talk to different people, they'll have different answers for this and different reasons why. Some people will land on the fact that they will say that this is proof that the Bible is not inerrant, that they will say that this was written by guys, and in the Old Testament, it was their understanding of God, and their understanding was when bad things happened, it was God was causing it. And then in the New Testament, they met Jesus, and it was changing, and so they weren't writing things in the, this is some people's opinion, not mine, but some people believe that the Old Testament wasn't inspired by God saying, hey, I want you to write this down. It was just written out of experience. That when they experienced a loss in battle, they were saying, oh, that's because of sin. We've let God down. When they experienced a victory in battle, they were saying, okay, God is on our side. There are some that have wrestled with that because they don't have another answer to it. I don't know if I do a great job of reconciling this. I tend to spend more time in the New Testament than I do in the Old Testament because there are just times when my little feeble human mind really struggles with God saying to do this. Where I land on, though, is I know it's the exact same God because one characteristic that is said of God over and over again in the Old Testament and the New Testament is that God is good and that God is love. And all the other details around what happened or their interpretation of it or my interpretation of those events, I go back to saying, I don't understand why God would say this or why God would do this in the Old Testament, but I can read over and over again in the Old Testament that ultimately God is good and God is love. And when I see Jesus, I see those two characteristics, that Jesus is good and Jesus is love. And so how I reconcile is I go back to that and I hold on to the things that I can understand. And I do think that there are some human ways to help understand some of the things that God has done. Just for example, you read the Old Testament, it's very easy for us to judge God or judge what they did and say that it was evil. But just put yourself in someone else's shoes for just a second. I don't know what you believe in disciplining your own kids. let's say that you practice, one SWAT, or you practice a timeout, or maybe you fussed at your kids. I don't know what your discipline was. But just imagine that your kid is just being belligerent and just being totally disrespectful and needs to be disciplined. And someone doesn't see what your kid has done. It's happening in the car. They're in the car seat. They're just freaking out, causing just a huge storm. Someone pulls up in their car, and they get out right as they see you reacting to your kid. Well, what story are they going to complete in their mind? They're not going to think that you're good or that you're loving. They're going to say, how awful is that parent? I can't believe they just spanked that kid, or they just yelled at that kid, or they fussed at that kid, or they took him and put him in timeout. That parent is so unloving, but they are only seeing a portion of the entire story. And so with the Old Testament, there are lots of times where I like to take a step back and say, I can't see this full story. God has a view that is way bigger and way different than mine, and God is seeing things and completing things. And so ultimately, I trust that if God led people to do something and if God was in certain circumstances that don't make sense to us, ultimately, God is good and God is love. And I'm just seeing a portion of the story. And one day, when I get to heaven, I hope to see how this is all my misperceptions of God were just totally blown away, and how I can see how truly good he was and how loving he was in every circumstance. But there are times, there are times when I say, okay, I'm going to read through an Old Testament book, and midway through the book, I just say, I got to get out of here, and I got to go back to the New Testament, because it's just, there are some things to wrestle on. If you're sensitive, I'm a sensitive guy. There are certain things that just, affect me differently than, I mean, some of you are just stone cold. Like, it doesn't affect you. You don't cry at Bambi. Those of you that you know, you like the movie Old Yeller. Those of you that are just stone cold, you can read through it. Oh, no big deal. You know, that's great. But for others, you wrestle with it. And so ultimately, that's how I wrestle with it, that I think God is the same God in both the Old Testament and New Testament. Ultimately, God is good, and God is love. Hopefully, I didn't butcher that too much. Let's keep going with another question. When dating, is it okay to not date someone only because they don't believe in God when we're called to bring others to know Jesus? Man, I'm glad whoever's asking that question is asking that question. The typical youth group verse that I taught for years when I was a youth pastor was that you should not be unequally yoked. And the idea behind this is that when farmers in like Jesus' day, when they had to plow a field, they had this thing called the yoke, and it would fit on the ox's neck. And one ox could do decent work, but two oxes could do a lot more. And they would put this like wooden piece around the ox's neck. And the idea was it should not be unequally yoked, in that you know, you wouldn't want to put like a little baby ox with like a big ox, because it's going to make your field differently. Your work's going to be so much easier if you guys are on the exact same page. And so that's the typical standard answer. I have friends, though, that met someone that didn't believe in God, and through their relationship, they ended up believing in God and became a Christian, and now they're a great married family. They have kids, and now even grandkids, and they were in my wedding and been a huge influence in me. And so I do think it is possible for it to happen, even though it goes against what I taught for years in youth group. I would say, though, that this is something that before I would get my emotions too wrapped up in someone, before I would start committing my heart to someone, I would want to find out how willing they are to line up with the things that are very important to me. Because one of the things that could happen is that you could jump into a relationship and start falling in love and getting wrapped up in it, and you could find after someone's proposed that they really have no interest in ever believing in God, and then you get married, and then kids come along, and it's like, well, hey, I really want our kids to go to church, and your spouse now is not supporting it. So I see the caution in saying, hey, you need to find someone that is supportive. The question, though, is when dating, is it okay to date someone only because they don't believe in God, or not to date someone? I think that you've got to play this by ear. If you're on a first date and the guy is just like, I hate God, then say, I'll pray for you, brother, and you know, we'll see you later. But if someone is open to it and is like, hey, you know, I've never experienced God, or you know, I would tend to stay on the friendship side of things until you saw their heart and their willingness to kind of fall in love with God and their willingness to support you on that. I would be very leery, even though I think God can do amazing things, I would be very leery of dating someone that was just anti-God, anti-church, because I think it could bring some difficulties later on in the relationship. But yeah, I don't know if it's a complete black or white answer, but I started with giving you the youth group answer with the ox, and I don't have a fat clue why I started that, but that's what I gave you. So, all right, let's keep going. What do you think of people who claim to have psychic powers? Do you think that some of those that genuinely believe they speak to those in heaven believe in the Bible? I wonder if this is coming. I mean, does someone out there know a psychic that believes in the Bible? What do you think of people who claim to have psychic powers? Do you think that some of those that genuinely believe they speak to those in heaven believe in the Bible? We actually covered this topic about a year and a half ago, and God was very clear that we should be very careful with trying to connect with the dead, or that we should try to speak to the dead. And ultimately, we don't need to talk to someone that is dead when we have someone that is alive in God and in Jesus that we can speak to and talk to and get wisdom from. So I think it's very clear that there are some things, some spiritual things that happen out there that I don't fully understand, and I think we need to be very careful. I think it is an offense to God. I think it is an offense to God to try to go and say, God, I don't want to make time for you or what you say. I want to go talk to someone who is dead. So I think we need to be very careful with it. Is there a psychic out there that also believes in the Bible? I'm sure there is. There's a lot of crazy people out there that believe a lot of things. So there probably is a psychic out there that believes it, but my ultimate thought is a psychic is, why go to someone, especially paying someone? Why would you pay someone to speak into your life who is speaking to someone who might be dead when you could talk to God who is alive and you don't have to pay for it. Like, if someone really had this gift to speak, I would want them to do it for the benefit of humans and not making money off of it. And so I personally stay away from horoscopes and psychics, and I try to wrap my mind around what is God saying for me now, today, and not someone else's opinion. And it's being judgmental, but I'm judging their motives. If they really wanted to help me, come over to my house and do it for free. Why am I paying you for a service that, that's how I feel. Sorry if you're a psychic, but you saw that one coming, if you are. Let's keep going. Why were all the idols the Israelites worship calves? I don't know. They liked cows. I don't know. There was an understanding in the Old Testament, it's very easy for us to wrap our, even though it seems really stupid for them to build a calf, they would build these calves and they would worship, and you think that's so dumb, but it is easy for us to understand their mindset when you start thinking about when you're struggling and you want a sign from God. when you're struggling and you want a sign from God, you want something that you can hold on to, that you can control. And ultimately, the Israelites, what they were doing is they were just following culture. And culture was, we want to create gods that we can control. And so if you make it with your own hands, then you can control the god. And so it wasn't about finding the right god. It was about finding a god that they can control. And things they control are images that they see. So they would create images based off of, you know, animals that they could see and say, okay, this then is our god, and we'll worship it, but we really ultimately want to control this thing. And this is why it is very often in like the Old Testament, in that mindset, one of the first things they wanted to know when they met a god is, what is your name? And the reason they want to know their name is so they can control it. You can't control a nameless being. And so Moses, actually, when he meets God for the first time, what is one of the first questions he asks him? What should I call you? And this was just their mindset of, unless I know who you are, I can't control you, I can't wrap my mind around you. And God's response to him was, I am that I am. And so it was like, even in my response, I'm going to blow your mind, and you can't control I am. And so I think ultimately they did it so they could control something, so they could have something they could sit on their mantle and say, okay, that's my God, I'll believe in it, but also I can control that thing. And God destroyed that and said, look, I don't want you to be praying to and worshiping these things that you make. I want you to worship the one true God who is so much bigger than anything you can make with your own hands. All right, let's keep going. How do you determine which portions of the Bible are figurative and which are literal? I think I kind of covered that in the last question. But I think ultimately you have to do some research on your own. How do you determine which portions of the Bible are figurative and which are literal? You have to do a little bit of research, and you also have to have a lot of humility to understand that there are no authors of the Bible that are around today. So one of the big debates about figurative versus literal comes in the science realm of, there are lots of Christians who hold to, we live on a young earth, and that it was literally made in 7 days, and that the Bible explains this as God created these things in 7 days, and this is literally how it happened. And there are lots of Christians who really hold on to that. And there's lots of Christians who are more in the science world, and they say there's some science things that are not supporting that, so they kind of wrestle with it. And I really do think this is where research comes in. I think that if you base your knowledge and your theology and your understanding of God based off a few Sunday school classes that you sat in as a child, you're going to miss the true intent. And I think a question that we should always be asking when we're reading the Bible is, what was the author's original intent? And so, like, when you take the example of creation, all throughout Genesis, there's often times where they do give figurative stories, that they gave stories to help us understand things. And this makes total sense, because even in Jesus' day, when Jesus starts talking, what was the number one way that Jesus communicated with the crowds? Parables, right? And so none of us think that when Jesus told a parable, that was a literal story, that when Jesus was talking about a story of something happening, that it literally happened and he's referencing a story. We just think he's telling a story to make a point. And that is a very common teaching, especially in the Jewish mindset, So there are times in the Old Testament especially where there are stories that I think probably were figurative, that there were, your brain can't really wrap around what happened, you can't understand this story. At the end of the day though, I think that if it's going to cause you to stumble in your faith, if you need it to be black or white, if you need it to be just yes or no, then just take it as literal and don't ask any more questions. If you though are more of the science mindset and want to wrestle with things, start asking some questions and ask the question about the original author's intent. When they wrote this, what was their intent? So for example, I think that God created the earth in 7 days. That's very easy for my brain to wrap around. But I also think that Moses was probably a good storyteller, and there are probably some aspects to the creation story that were parable-like. That I think it may have happened like that, but it was more of like a, hey, your brain can't comprehend it completely, so similar to how Jesus told parables, I'm going to tell you a parable. Now, could I be wrong in that? Yeah. Could I be right in that? Yeah. I mean, Moses isn't here. Most people believe Moses wrote Genesis. Moses isn't here for me to ask, hey, what is your opinion? What is way easier for me, though, is to not wrestle with that at all and just take it for what it is. That where I get into trouble is where I start analyzing something for what it wasn't intended to be. For example, the story of Genesis was not intended to be a science book that answered all of your questions about creation and about how we got here. It was not intended to be that. Ultimately, the book of Genesis is written so that you can know that you were created by a God who loves you and who does have a plan, and that humans messed up the plan by sinning. And ultimately, I think everyone can agree with that is the part of that is the point of the creation story. But at the end of the day, you know, there are times when I've read through the creation story and I see Adam and Eve talking to a snake, and I just think, like, did all animals talk back then? Like, was it just one big happy Disney movie? Like, did they, you know, why didn't they freak out when a snake started talking to them? Like, that would have been my first clue that something weird is happening here. But Genesis wasn't written to answer that question. And so I don't know. Was there a literal snake that Satan took on the form and tempted them? Was it literal? Yeah. No. I mean, I don't know. Like, at the end of the day, though, what is the point of Genesis? The point of Genesis was not, did this happen exactly like this? The point of Genesis is to paint a picture of where we all can agree that we are broken sinners that need a Savior. And ultimately, that's what Genesis points to. And so if you are I need a black or white answer, I'm going to frustrate you a lot of the time, because I just don't think that we can have answers to everything, because those authors aren't here for us to say, hey, what did you really intend? What did you really mean by that? And at the end of the day, I can't wait to get to heaven where he just blows away all my misperceptions and all my bad theology and just says, Rob, you were such a goofball. Why did you believe that? I think it's going to be really cool to experience and to see things in the way that he sees them. We have one more minute, and I'll try to cram one more question in this one more minute. So let's go with one last question. Oh man, the next question is even tougher. How do you know what God's plan is for you? Great question. God's plan is for you ultimately to honor God with your life. And so there are different camps, though, depending on who you want to talk to or who you believe. There are some camps that believe that God has pre-wired and preordained everything that happens to you. He's already got a plan. And so if you ate Lucky Charms today, that was because God wired you to eat Lucky Charms. Everything. If you're here today, it's because God pre-wired, he hardwired you to come to Next Level Church today. So there are some that believe that, and I respect them for believing that. I have friends that really hold to that, and we can agree to disagree. There are others, though, that believe that there is an ultimate will to God, and there are some things we know that are going to happen. Ultimately, we believe Jesus is coming back, and that's going to happen. And when Jesus comes back, a lot of things change. Every knee will bow, every tongue will confess that Jesus is Lord, and a lot of stuff changes. But up in between then, that definitive moment of time that's happening, I think God gives us a lot of freedom to live our lives for him. And ultimately, his plan for you is that you honor God with your life. And so when you're making a decision about a job or about who to marry or about where to go, you need to be asking this, is this honoring to God? And I think God cares way more about your character than he does about the decision that you make. Ultimately, God cares about your heart behind it. Why did you choose that job? Was it just to make yourself famous? Was it just to make more money? Or was it so that you can bless, be a bigger blessing in the kingdom of heaven? Why did you date that person? It's because they make you feel good about yourself? Or is it because ultimately you're wanting to have a relationship that reflects God's love for the church? And so I think everything comes back to us trying to honor God with our lives, and I think God gives us a lot of freedom to make decisions. I really want to answer the next question, but I'm not going to. So maybe someone will ask it in the next hour, and it'll be on the podcast, because we are out of time. So here's what I want to do, though. I will do my best to take any questions that were asked that I didn't get to. I'll do my best to answer them this week on my blog, hopefully by Wednesday, Thursday time frame. And so my blog's robshep.com. If you're friends with me on Facebook, I'll advertise it there, and you can look at it. So if your question wasn't answered, I'll do my best to get to it later in the week. Sorry that we ran out of time. But I would love to pray for us and then end by singing out to God, because really, at the end of the day, Jesus is what it's all about. And it's not about my opinions or my understanding of the Bible. It is really about Him, and that's why we're here today. So I want to pray for us, and then we're going to end by singing out. God, I just thank You for the questions that are asked. I think it is incredibly important to ask questions. And I think that we need to be asking why we're here and what we're supposed to be doing. And God, I just thank You for the questions that were asked today. And I ask that, God, You would do something, that You would stir some more questions and more answers, and You would stir our hearts ultimately to You. I ask, God, that if there's anything that was said here, that we would not allow it to be divisive, but that, God, we would allow it to point us to You. Because at the end of the day, You desire our hearts, and You desire us to follow You and to walk humbly with You. And so I ask, God, today as we close by singing and worshiping, that, God, we would take our minds and our attention and our heart, and we would focus on You. I thank You for what You're doing in our church and in our lives. In Jesus' name, amen.
We hope you've enjoyed and learned from today's podcast. If you'd like to connect with us further, you can check out our website, nextlevelchurch.net, or find us on Facebook or Twitter.